for life. Sometimes people were not even locked up in a formal prison. To set an example, a carder in Kaiping chained up a grandmother accused of theft for 10 days in the canteen using 4.5 kilo fetters. A young militiaman struck matches to burn her feet. Special camps and special sanctions were devised throughout the country, as local justice was allowed to run rampant. In Yangtze County, Guizhou, the inmates of one camp had the character for thief imprinted on their forehead in red ink. Throughout the province, people's communes set up training centres, Tsisundui, where those who expressed critical views or refused to attend meetings were sent for re-education and compelled to undertake hard labour. Several training camps were also established by the Public Security Bureau in Liuchu in 1959 to take care of subversive elements who objected to collectivization. In Yanxing County, north of Beijing, the merest suspicion of slacking resulted in detention. A 62-year-old man spent a month in confinement for not having caught enough sparrows. If for every criminal handed over to the formal justice system, some 3 or 4 people were locked away in a local re-education camp, the total prisoner population would have reached 8 to 9 million in any one year during the Great Leap Forward, 1.8 to 2 million in labour camps, 6 to 8 million in re-education camps. The total number of deaths due to disease and starvation, conservatively estimated earlier at about 1 million in formal labour camps, would have to be multiplied by 3 or 4, meaning that at least 3 million died in the gulag during the famine. The death rate was high, but compared to the Soviet Union in the 1930s, the incarceration rate was relatively low. This is because comparatively few people actually did time for crime. They were beaten and starved instead. Chapter 34. Violence. Terror and violence were the foundations of the regime. Terror, to be effective, had to be arbitrary and ruthless. It had to be widespread enough to reach everyone, but did not have to claim many lives. This principle was well understood. Kill a chicken to scare the monkey, was a traditional saying. Carders who forced villages in Tongzhou, just outside the capital, to kneel before beating them called it, punish one to deter 100. However, during the Great Leap Forward, something of an altogether different nature happened in the countryside. Violence became a routine tool of control. It was not used occasionally on a few to instill fear in the many. Rather, it was directed systematically and habitually against anybody seen to dawdle, obstruct, or protest, let alone pilfer or steal, a majority of villagers. Every meaningful incentive to work was destroyed for the cultivator. The land belonged to the state. The grain he produced was procured at a price that was often below cost of production. His livestock, tools, and utensils were no longer his. Often even his home was confiscated. The local carder, on the other hand, faced even greater pressure to fulfill and overfulfill the plan, having to whip up the workforce in one relentless drive after another. The constant hammering of propaganda may have helped in the early days of the Great Leap Forward, but the daily meetings villagers were required to attend contributed to widespread sleep deprivation. Meetings every day, loudspeakers everywhere, remembered Li Popo when interviewed about the famine in Sichuan. Meetings, some of them lasting several days, were indeed at the heart of collectivization, but they were not so much a forum of socialist democracy, where the peasant masses openly voiced their views, as a site of intimidation, where carders could lecture, bully, threaten and shout themselves hoarse for hours on end. All too often, farmers were woken in the middle of the night to work in the fields after an evening at a village meeting, so that they slept for less than 3 or 4 hours a day in the ploughing season. In any event, as the promise of utopia was followed by yet another spell of back-breaking labour, the willingness to trade hard work for empty promises gradually eroded. Soon, the only way to extract compliance from an exhausted workforce was the threat of violence. Nothing short of fear of hunger, pain, or death seemed to be able to galvanize them. In some places, both villagers and carders became so brutalized that the scope and degree of coercion had to be constantly expanded, creating a mounting spiral of violence. With far fewer carrots to offer, the party relied more heavily on the stick. The stick was the weapon of choice in the countryside. It was cheap and versatile. A swing of the baton would punish a straggler, while a series of blows could lacerate the back of more stubborn elements. In serious cases, victims could be strung up and beaten black and blue. People were forced to kneel on broken shells and beaten. This happened, for instance, to Chen Wuxiong, who refused to work on an irrigation project far away from home. He was forced to kneel and hold a heavy log above his head, all the while being beaten with a stick by local carder Chen Longxiang. As famished villagers often suffered from edema, liquid seeped through their pores with every stroke of the stick. It was a common expression that someone was beaten until all the water came out, for instance in the case of Lu Qingfu, a farmer chased by a team of thugs. So enraged was their leader, Jin Zhongguang, first party secretary of Napeng Commune, Xin County, that he beat the man for 20 minutes. Party officials often took a lead. The report compiled by the local party committee, which investigated abuses in a commune, Xingwan, explained that the first party secretary, Deng Zhongxing, personally beat more than 200 farmers, killing 14 in an attempt to fulfill the quotas. The brains of Liu Shengmao, too sick to work at the reservoir in Huaminglu, Hunan, were widely spattered by the beating he received from the brigade secretary, who continued to pummel his lifeless body in a blind fury. Ao Desheng, party secretary of a commune in Hunan, single-handedly punched 150 people, of whom 4 died. "If you want to be a party member, you must know how to beat people," was his advice to new recruits. In Daoxian County, "Everywhere is a torture field," an investigation team wrote. Farmers were clubbed on a regular basis. One team leader personally beat 13 people to death. A further 9 subsequently died of their injuries. Some of these carders were veritable gangsters, their mere appearance instilling fear. In Nanhai County, brigade leader Liang Yanglong toted 3 guns and stalked the village in a big leather coat. Li Xianchun, team leader in Hebei, injected himself with morphine daily and would swagger about the village in bright red trousers, swearing loudly and randomly beating anybody who had the misfortune to catch his attention. Overall, across the country, maybe as many as half of all carders regularly pummeled or caned the people they were meant to serve, as endless reports demonstrate. 4,000 out of 16,000 villagers working on the Huangcai Reservoir in Hunan in the winter of 1959-60 were kicked and beaten, and 400 died as a result. In a Luoding commune in Guangdong, more than half of all carders beat the villagers, close to 100 being clubbed to death. A more comprehensive investigation of Xinyang, Henan, showed that over 1 million people died in 1960. Most died of starvation, but some 67,000 were beaten to death by the militias. The stick was common, but it was only one tool in the arsenal of horror devised by local carders to demean and torture those who failed to keep up. As the countryside slid into starvation, ever greater violence had to be inflicted on the famished to get them into the fields. The ingenuity deployed by the few to inflict pain and suffering on the many seemed boundless. People were thrown into ponds, sometimes bound, sometimes stripped of their clothes. In Luoding, a 10-year-old boy was tied up and thrown into a bog for having stolen a few stalks of wheat. He died after a few days. People were stripped naked and left in the cold. For stealing a kilo of beans, farmer Zhu Yufa was fined 120 yuan. His clothes, his blanket and his floor mat were confiscated. Then he was stripped naked and subjected to a struggle session. In one commune in Guangdong, where thousands of farmers were sent to do forced labor, stragglers were stripped of their clothes in the middle of winter. Elsewhere, in the rush to complete a reservoir, up to 400 villagers at a time were made to work in sub-zero temperatures without cotton-padded clothing. No exceptions were made for pregnant women. The cold, it was thought, would force the villagers to work more vigorously. In Liuyang, Hunan, a team of 300 men and women were made to work bare-chested in the snow. One in seven died. And then, in the summer, people were forced to stand in the glaring sun with arms spread out. Others had to kneel on stones or on broken glass. This happened from Sichuan in the south to Liaoning in the north. People were also burned with incandescent tools. Hot needles were used to singe navels. When farmers recruited to work on a reservoir in Lingbei commune complained about pain, the militia seared their bodies. In Hebei, people were branded with a hot iron. In Sichuan, a few were doused in petrol and set alight, some burning to death. Boiling water was poured over people. As fuel was scarce, it was more common to cover people in urine and excrement. One 80-year-old woman, who had the temerity to report her team leader for stealing rice, paid the price when she was drenched in urine. In Longhui commune near Shantou, those who failed to keep up with work were pushed into a heap of excrement, forced to drink urine, or had their hands burned. Elsewhere, a runny concoction of excrement diluted with water was poured down a victim's throat. Huang Bingyin, a villager weakened by starvation, stole a chicken but was caught and forced by the village leader to swallow cow dung. Liu Desheng, guilty of poaching a sweet potato, was covered in urine. He, his wife and his son were also forced into a heap of excrement. Then tongs were used to prise his mouth open after he refused to swallow excrement. He died 3 weeks later. Mutilation was carried out everywhere. Hair was ripped out. Ears and noses were lopped off. After Chen Di, a farmer in Guangdong, stole some food, he was tied up by militiaman Chen Xiu, who cut off one of his ears. The case of Wang Ziyu was reported to the central leadership. One of his ears was chopped off, his legs were tied up with wire, a 10-kilo stone was dropped on his back, and then he was branded with a hot iron as punishment for digging up a potato. In Yuanling County, Hunan, testicles were beaten, soles of feet were branded, and noses were stuffed with hot peppers. Ears were nailed against the wall. In the Liuang region, Hunan, iron wires were used to chain farmers. In Xianyang, Sichuan, an iron wire was run through the ears of thieves, pulled down by the weight of a piece of cardboard, which read, "Habitual Thief." Others had needles inserted under their nails. In several parts of Guangdong, carders injected salt water into people with needles normally used on cattle. Sometimes husbands and wives were forced to beat each other, a few to death. One elderly man, when interviewed for this book in 2006, quietly sobbed when he recounted how as a young boy he and the other villagers had been forced to beat a grandmother, tied up in the local temple for having taken wood from the forest. People were intimidated by mock executions and mock burials. They were also buried alive. This was often mentioned in reports about Hunan. People were locked up in a cellar and left to die in eerie silence after a period of frantic screaming and scratching against the hatch. The practice was widespread enough to prompt a query by provincial boss Zhu Xiaozhu during a visit to Fengling County in November 1958. Humiliation was the trusted companion of pain. Everywhere people were paraded, sometimes with a dunce cap, sometimes with a placard on their chests, sometimes entirely naked. Faces were smeared with black ink. People were given yin and yang haircuts, as one half of the head was shaved, the other not. Verbal abuse was rife. The Red Guards, 10 years later during the Cultural Revolution, invented very little. Punishment also extended to the hereafter. Sometimes the corpses of those who had been beaten to death were simply left to rot by the roadside, destined to become pariahs of the afterlife, their wandering ghosts, according to popular belief, never able to rest without proper burial rites. Signs were put up by some graves. In Longwy Commune, Guangdong, where 1 in 5 died in 1959, some people were hastily buried by the roadside, the site marked by a signboard with the word sluggard. In Ximen, Hunan, the entire family of Mao Bingxiang starved to death, but the brigade leader refused to give them a burial. After a week, rats had gnawed through their eyes. Local people later told an investigation team that, "We people are not even like dogs. Nobody buries us when we die." Family members could be punished for trying to bury a relative who had fallen foul of local justice. When a 70-year-old mother hanged herself to escape from hunger, her child hurried back home from the fields in a panic. But the local carter was infuriated by the breach of discipline. He chased the daughter down the road, punched her head, and then, when she was down, kicked her upper body. She was crippled for life. "You can keep her and eat her," he said of her mother, whose body was left for days to decompose. The worst form of desecration was to chop up the body and use it as fertilizer. This happened with Deng Daming, beaten to death because his child had stolen a few broad beans. Party Secretary Dan Niming ordered his body to be simmered down into fertilizer for a field of pumpkins. The extent of the violence is difficult to underestimate. In a province such as Hunan, which did not rank as one of the worst in terms of overall casualties, a report by a central inspection committee addressed to Zhou Enlai at the time noted that people were beaten to death in 82 out of 86 counties and cities. But it is harder to come up with reliable figures, and none are likely ever to be produced for the whole country. It was difficult enough for investigators at the time to determine how many people had died during the famine, let alone ascertain the cause of death. But some of the team sent to the countryside probed further and came up with a rough idea of what had happened on the ground. In Daoxian County, Hunan, many thousands perished in 1960, but only 90% of the deaths could be attributed to disease and starvation. Having reviewed all the evidence, the team concluded that 10% had been buried alive, clubbed to death, or otherwise killed by party members and the militia. In Ximen County, Hunan, some 13,500 died in 1960, of whom 12% were beaten or driven to their deaths. In Xinjiang, a region subject to an inquiry headed by senior leaders such as Li Xianyan, 1 million people died in 1960. A formal investigation committee estimated that 6 to 7% were beaten to death. In Sichuan, the rates were much higher. In Kaixian County, a close examination by a team sent by the provincial party committee at the time concluded that in Fengle Commune, where 17% of the population had perished in less than a year, up to 65% of the victims had died because they were beaten, punished with food deprivation, or forced into committing suicide. Report after report detailed the ways in which people were tortured, and the image that emerges from this mass of evidence is that at least 6 to 8% of all the famine victims were directly killed or died as a result of injuries inflicted by carders and the militia. As we shall see in chapter 35, at least 45 million people perished above a normal death rate during the famine from 1958 to 1962. Given the extent and scope of violence so abundantly documented in the party archives, it is likely that at least 2.5 million of these victims were beaten or tortured to death. There is no simple explanation for the violence that underpinned crash collectivization. One might very well point to a tradition of violence stretching back many centuries in China. But how would that have been any different from the rest of the world? Europe was steeped in blood, and mass murder took an unprecedented number of lives in the first half of the 20th century. Modern dictatorships can be particularly murderous in their combination of new technologies of power exercised through the one-party state with new technologies of death from the machine gun to the gas chamber. When powerful states decide to pool these resources to exterminate entire groups of people, the overall consequences can be devastating. Genocide, after all, is made possible only with the advent of the modern state. The one-party state under Mao did not concentrate all its resources on the extermination of specific groups of people, with the exception, of course, of counter-revolutionaries, saboteurs, spies, and other enemies of the people. Political categories vague enough potentially to include anybody and everybody. But Mao did throw the country into the great leap forward, extending the military structure of the party to all of society. "Everyone a soldier," Mao had proclaimed at the height of the campaign, brushing aside such bourgeois niceties as a salary, a day off each week, or a prescribed limit on the amount of labour a worker should carry out. A giant people's army in the command economy would respond to every beck and call of its generals. Every aspect of society was organized along military lines, with canteens, boarding kindergartens, collective dormitories, shock troops and villagers construed as the foot soldiers in a continuous revolution. These were not merely martial terms rhetorically deployed to heighten group cohesion. All the leaders were military men attuned to the rigors of warfare. They had spent 20 years fighting a guerrilla war in extreme conditions of deprivation. They had coped with one extermination campaign after another, unleashed by the nationalist regime of Chiang Kai-shek, and then managed to survive the onslaught of the Japanese army in the Second World War. They had come through the vicious purges and bouts of torture which periodically convulsed the party itself. They glorified violence and were inured to massive loss of life. And all of them shared an ideology in which the end justified the means. In 1962, having lost millions of people in his province, Li Xinsuan compared the great leap forward to the long march, in which only 1 in 10 had made it to the end. "We are not weak. We are stronger. We have kept the backbone." On the ground, party officials showed the same callous disregard for human life as they had to the millions mobilized into the bloody offensives against Chiang Kai-shek. The brute force with which the country had been conquered was now to be unleashed on the economy, regardless of the casualty figures. And as sheer human willpower was deemed capable of just about any feat, mountains could be moved. Any failure looked suspiciously like sabotage. A slacker in the war on sparrows was a bad element who could derail the entire military strategy of the Great Leap Forward. A farmer who pilfered from the canteen was a soldier gone astray, to be eliminated before the platoon was threatened with mutiny. Anybody was potentially a deserter or a spy or a traitor, so that the slightest infraction was met with the full rigor of martial justice. The country became a giant boot camp in which ordinary people no longer had a say in the tasks they were commanded to carry out, despite the pretense of socialist democracy. They had to follow orders, failing which they risked punishment. Whatever checks existed on violence religion, law, community, family were simply swept away. As the party purged itself several times during the Great Leap Forward, it also recruited new members, many of them unsavory characters who felt little compunction in using violence to get the job done. The village, commune or county with the most red flags was generally also the one with the most victims. But red flags could be taken away and given to a rival at any moment, forcing local cadres to keep up the pressure, although the workforce was increasingly exhausted. A vicious circle of repression was created, as ever more relentless beatings were required to get the starving to perform whatever tasks were assigned to them. In the escalation of violence, the limit was reached when the threat of punishment and the threat of starvation cancelled each other out. One villager forced to work long shifts up in the mountains in the cold of winter put it succinctly, "We are exhausted. Even if you beat me, I won't work." The way in which violence escalated at the time was analysed in an extremely interesting manuscript entitled How and Why Cadres Beat People, written by one of the investigation teams dispatched to the countryside in Hunan. The authors of the report not only spent time collecting incriminating evidence against cadres guilty of abuse of power, but they also interviewed them in a rare attempt to find out what had gone wrong. They discovered the reward principle. Cadres beat villagers to earn praise from their superiors. However chaotic the situation was on the ground, violence always followed a line, namely from the top towards the bottom. Zhao Zhengcheng was an example. A low-ranking party member, at first he refused to hit people suspected of being rightists in the purges following the 1959 Lushan plenum. He was taken to task by his superiors, and even risked being denounced as a conservative rightist himself. But he continued to express reluctance at using violence against party enemies. So he was fined 5 yuan as a warning. Then, at long last, he succumbed to the pressure, coming back with a vengeance, bashing a small child till it was covered in blood. Peer pressure all too often dragged local cadres down to the same level, binding all in a shared camaraderie of violence. In Leiyang, county leader Zhang Donghai and his acolytes considered violence to be a duty intrinsic to the continuous revolution. Having a campaign is not the same as doing embroidery. It is impossible not to beat people to death. Local cadres who refused to beat slackers were themselves subjected to struggle sessions, tied up and beaten. Some 260 were dismissed from their jobs. 30 were beaten to death. In Hechuan County, Sichuan, cadres were told that there are so many people working, it doesn't matter if you beat a few to death. Some of the interviews collected by party inspectors in 1961 confronted the perpetrators of violence with their victims. Xiao Kenan was a young Hunanese who was beaten for the first time in the summer of 1958 at the height of the collectivization frenzy. Dispatched to work for 12 hours a day in the middle of the winter on an irrigation project in the Huaoguo Mountains, he was covered in blows again. One of his tormentors was a cadre called Yi Xiaohua. Xiao knew Yi from his childhood, and recalled that the man had never resorted to violence before the Great Leap Forward. With the unfolding of new political campaigns, he changed, beating and cursing on a mere whim. He punched hard, leaving his victims bruised, battered and bleeding. When Yi Xiaohua, in turn, was asked why he was so violent, he explained that the pressure had come from his superior. Yi was afraid of being labelled a rightist. His boss told him that, if you don't beat them, the work won't get done. The pressure had to be passed along a chain of command. The people above us squeeze us, so we have to squeeze the people below us. In other words, as party members were terrorised themselves, they in turn terrorised the population under their control. Cadres had a choice. they could improve the living conditions of the villagers, against all odds, or instead try to meet the party's targets. The one came at the expense of the other.